So between now and 12 o'clock, I'm going to be talking about a subject that for many will be difficult to hear. I hope, though, if you are able to listen, you'll realise why it's something we want to bring to your attention. We're going to touch on some difficult themes, including sexual offences against children. If you are listening with youngsters or it's an issue that's particularly sensitive to you, perhaps step away from us. Come back to us at 12. I should say that if this discussion raises issues that affect you, there's a range of organisations and websites which can offer you advice and support. You can find them listed on the BBC's Action Line website, bbc.co.uk/actionline. Now, every year, thousands of families with young children have their everyday lives turned upside down when the police knock at their door, arresting the father on suspicion of downloading indecent images of children. The trauma of discovering their partner is an alleged sex offender destroys the lives they knew. Relationships are shattered, families divided, friendships lost, many face financial ruin. Campaigners have told this programme that some families are left with no support to pick up the pieces. I've been speaking to mum of two, and I'm calling her Lucy. We're not using her real name, and her words are spoken by an actor, so we can protect the identity of her children. Lucy told me about her experience from the start, from the knock.
There was a knock at the door. I think I just presumed it was just a very early delivery man. So I kind of went downstairs in my dressing gown, opened the door, and there was five plainclothes police officers who asked to come inside. They very quickly explained that they were here to arrest my husband. It was a big, big shock. My husband was not at home. He was coming home from working away. So they then went on to explain that they were going to be arresting him for viewing indecent images of children. I'm quite an emotional person. I kind of instantly started crying. One of the police officers reassured me that it wasn't pictures of my own children. They went outside and decided that they were going to wait at the end of the street. And my husband came home, came in the house, kind of gave him a hug, like, hi, where have you been? And I think he instantly knew from the look on my face. He said, what's wrong? And I'm inside, kind of just hoping that the police are going to time this perfectly, like you see on TV. You know, they're going to have seen him come down the road and save me from having to do this. And instead, I had to look my husband in the face and say, the police were here this morning. They want to arrest you for viewing indecent images of children. And I think at that point, the look on my husband's face was like white as a sheet, like a ghost. But he knew. He knew that was coming. I could tell. And he just lowered his head and he just said, I am so sorry.
He didn't deny it.
No, he just, yeah. And I think, speaking to him afterwards, he said the really complex relief that he felt, that finally this was not a secret that he was having to hold, but the devastation he knew he brought on the family was really, really complex. And at that point, then, he was taken down to the police station and his devices were checked at the house. So they only took devices of his that were relevant. They didn't take everyone's devices, which was a godsend. I still had my phone. The children still had their consoles and things like that. And that was it. That whirlwind of kind of 3 or 4 hours in the morning had just stopped. There was like a deathly silence. And they just said, we will let you know when he is released.
I suppose, firstly, social services got involved. Your husband was not allowed to see the children. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So they got involved straight away. I saw them the day after his arrest, and my husband was allowed no contact at all. And that actually ended up lasting for 6 months.
Had you told your children why their father wasn't there?
Yeah, so I told my eldest child first, being that bit older. I was able to have that conversation with them. And their understanding, being that bit older, we could have a bit of a better conversation about it. My youngest initially just kind of knew that the dad was struggling with mental health, so we left that as it was, and we didn't tell them until about 3 or 4 weeks later.
How do you tell a child that?
That is a great question. No one could offer me that advice. Social services didn't offer me that advice. The police, no one could give me any support in doing that.
How did you tell your children?
I think by the time we'd spoken to the children, the understanding of where my husband was at, the difference between the predator of children that we're portrayed and the point of which my husband had got to, and why this had ended up where it was, made it easier to not kind of vilify my husband, because that would have created such a polarising thing for my children to understand, you know, at such a young age. It was already hard enough not to see their dad, but to then tell them that their dad was actually, you know, looking at these images, and instantly they were like, why? So, with a lot of work, research, understanding, kind of driven by myself, being able to get to a point where I could somehow reconcile the person that we were living with someone who could get to the position to be looking at these images.
He spent time away from the house, didn't he? How much time was that?
Yeah, he did. So he ended up living in a rented room in a house for about a year, actually.
And was that your choice or social services?
So it was social services' choice and partly his bail conditions. So he wasn't able to actually speak to anyone under the age of 18 immediately after his arrest for about a month. And then social services conditions meant he wasn't able to live at the property 11, 12 months from his arrest.
He wasn't allowed access to the children?
He wasn't allowed access to the children for 6 months after his arrest.
So you effectively became a single parent?
Yeah, overnight.
What was your contact with him like?
It was really difficult. So on the day of his arrest, knowing he was not allowed to come back to the family home, the police had to find him somewhere to be released to. That was really difficult. He doesn't have a very strong relationship with his mother. Pretty much all of our friends have children, so he couldn't go to anyone else's house. So the position we had to be in was... I luckily have a very supportive dad. He came to my house to look after the children, and then I had to be the one who had to pick my husband up from the police station, and we went to my dad's for a few nights. So the pressure from the kind of get-go was... Your husband is extremely suicidal. We cannot just release him from this arrest without knowing he's going to be safe. You're the only person we can release him to.
I don't even know how you'd approach a situation like that. Did you tell your dad why he'd been arrested?
I didn't straight away. I just said, Dad, I just need you to come and stay at the house for a few days, and we need to go and be at your house. And he didn't ask. It was only the next day, I think, after I got more information from my husband about... Like, what, how long, to what extent, why? Then I was able to really have that conversation with my dad, like, look, this is what's going on.
Did you consider what your future would be with your husband?
I think I still do, daily. It's a really difficult battle to be in.
Let's establish then what happened to him. He was arrested.
Yeah, so he'd admitted he'd accessed indecent images of children to the police in his first interview. So they had to establish the evidence in order to go to the Crown Prosecution Service. So the devices go through forensic analysis at that point. It took 9 months for that to happen, and they didn't find any images, any evidence on his device, on any of his devices. So at that point, the case was dropped. The police did sort of call him in and discuss kind of what work are you doing around this behaviour, like what courses have you done, how have you approached it, and he'd spent a lot of money accessing the courses that are available. At that point, we were just left. No support, not like... We weren't in any version of a system anymore. There was no justice system to go through. We just walked out of that police station like the arrest had never happened.
Yet in the meantime, your children had had no contact with their father. Birthdays, etc.
Yeah, he had to miss their birthdays. He asked whether or not he'd be allowed to send a text message, and the social services didn't even allow him to text me a version of happy birthday for the children for their birthdays.
And you and your children have had support?
So there was no support. When I spoke to the police and said, look, my husband is getting support left, right and centre. He's got liaison and diversion who come and make sure he isn't a suicide risk. He's able to access Stop It Now. All of these things that are set up in order to support him. Where can I go? And they just said, the social services are your point of support. And I spoke to the social services and said, look, you're meant to be my support. Like, I'm struggling. Like, this is really difficult. This is not where I'm, like, meant to be. This is not my life. And there was just no support from social services. That was taken down as, this woman is struggling to cope. She's in denial.
Denial of what?
Denial that my husband was any version of a risk to my children.
Did you ever think about that?
Absolutely, yeah.
How did you determine he wasn't?
I determined he wasn't because after the social services had done their initial talk to the children, they established that there was no physical harm to the children. Speaking to the police had categorised him as low risk. And I think at that point, we'd been living with this man who had been looking at indecent images of children and living a normal life. And my children had not been at risk.
Had you spoken to your children?
Yeah, I did.
About their relationship with their father?
I did, yeah. I did have to have that conversation with them.
To establish if there had been any...
Yeah, just... Yeah.
That must have been so difficult.
It's so unbelievably difficult. It's never a position you expect to be in. And I think it's really... It's just such a delicate thing to not want to put further burden or further pressure on your children when they're going through so much. Like, as a mother, you want to take all of that from them as much as possible.
Have you been able to talk to any of your friends about this? Do any of your friends know?
Initially, I spoke to the children and we kind of created a circle of support for them. So I spoke to my eldest child about, like, what are two safe adults that you would like to know what's happening? So that if there is something you do need to speak about, like, who would you go to? And sort of following what I know after sort of my work, like, what are safeguarding principles, like ensuring that children have safe adults they can go to? So very quickly establish that for them. So I did tell my cousin I'm really close to. I told my mum and my dad. And I did try and tell friends, but just the instant kind of rejection from some of them and isolation. Like, I never, ever want anyone else to have to understand where I'm at and what my family are going through.
Why are you still with your husband? People will be listening and absolutely baffled as to why you're still with him.
I think if you'd have asked me, would you stay with your husband if he had been viewing indecent images of children before this, before experiencing this, I would have absolutely, probably like 99% of the population gone, nah, I would go. But the compounded trauma around everything we experienced and the fact that essentially from the day of the knock, we're kind of swapped parallel lives. Like, that was the point in which my husband was no longer accessing these images. He's no longer doing that. Like, essentially, the person who is with the man who's already done that has already been and gone. That time has already happened. Like, I've already been that woman. And now there was a point of just trying to establish a stable environment for my children. Essentially, my personal relationship with my husband is forever going to be turbulent and difficult. But there is a point of personal sacrifice for me that means I will not put my children through any further trauma.
Do your children see a mother who is happy?
Yeah, absolutely. At times we are a happy family. There are absolute glimmers of normal life and life that the children knew before this trauma.
Why are you talking to me today? Why is it important that people hear your experience of this?
I just think the sheer amount of arrests that are happening at the moment, the sheer amount of families that are going through this, that have pushed into, like, forced isolation.
Because it's not the arrests that are bad.
It's the aftermath. No, like, I think you could speak to anyone and the arrests, I would say the arrests absolutely have to happen. There is not a mother out there who wouldn't want children to be protected and to be safe, absolutely. It is the aftermath. It's the lack of support, the lack of infrastructure out there. The fact that my children and me had to pay for professional private therapists and like, I'm in so much debt now from that period of time because I had to fund therapy for both of my children and myself to get through that prolonged period of trauma. I mean, I still have therapy now. My children still access counselling support within their school structure. It's such an ongoing, like, impact. And I'm talking now and trying to share my story because there will be women out there who are isolated, who feel like they have to answer for their husbands, or they don't know whether or not they should stay or should go, or they feel like they can't make a decision. Like, some days I wake up and I can't bear what he's done. I can't bear it. I can't bear to look at him. I can't even think of it. And then there are other days when it's just normal. It's just normal. And my husband is happier and healthier than he's ever been mentally. And I just think partners just need some support. We are, as mothers, treated as like secondary perpetrators from the get-go. And I think it's so difficult to hear a story of a woman who has stayed with their husband because somehow they think that must be us condoning the behaviour. And it's just absolutely not the case. Like, it couldn't be further from the truth. A lot of us are just really traumatised women and mothers trying to keep our families from going under.
Lucy, I wish you and your family well. I know it's 2 years on, but the hurt and the fragility of the situation to many extents and you ploughing on is evident. And I think you talking to me definitely put some focus on this and make us all think. I wish you and your family well.
Thank you.
So I can't thank Lucy enough for talking to me about that. Many of you have reacted. I'll get to those in a moment. Jenny Greensmith is director of Safer Lives, which offers specialist support for people being investigated for online and other sexual offences, and co-founder of Talking Forward, a charity which offers peer support for families affected by what they call the knock. Jenny, morning to you. What is Safer Lives and how are people referred to you for help?
Morning, Naga. So Safer Lives is an agency that works predominantly with people, as you said, who've committed online sexual offences. And the people that we work with are usually signposted to us by the police forces that are arresting them. And the aim of our work is to, it's about helping people make changes. Nobody wants to be a sex offender. You know, we don't believe that people are born bad and that this is, you know, their kind of, what's the word, their destiny. You know, there's different paths towards the behaviour and that's what we're trying to address. And also it's about the suicide risk. You know, Lucy, I think, alluded to just the absolute emotional turmoil that is there for the family. And within that, there is, you know, the suspect themselves. The current figures are that for every 1,000 people arrested, 8 will take their own lives. And it's about 1,000 people arrested a month. So, you know, we can all do the figures there. And that's 8 families each month where some, you know, whose dad is going to die effectively. We can't shy away from that. So a lot of the work that we do is about trying to prevent that also.
Caroline's messaged in saying this lady's amazing. Brave to stand by her husband and to try to understand something that most people would just walk away from. Her children are extremely lucky to have her. Her honesty and vulnerability is commendable. I've been through something similar and I'm extremely grateful to hear her story. There is that question, isn't there? And I think Lucy put it, as we're calling her, so well. She said, if you'd asked me before, I'd have been, nah, I'm out of there. But she stayed. And is that normal?
There isn't a normal, and that's a question we get very often from families, is how should I behave? There's no rule book to this. And because we don't talk about it, nobody knows what someone else would do. We know that as a society, we are disgusted by sexual offences against children, and that's what we're brought up. And therefore, we all believe that it is other people that do that. You know, it's not our dads, our brothers, our sons. And therefore, we can say, well, we would leave because, you know, we're good people. And then when it happens, you know, it's predominantly, more than any other type of offence and sexual offence, we've got mainly white, middle-aged, middle-class men, you know, a stereotypical person that's going to commit this offence. So they are your people who don't have experience of criminal justice and whose families are absolutely blown apart because it's come from nowhere. And as Lucy says, you assume that you'll leave and you're judged for staying. Some people are also judged for leaving as well by other family members or people that think they should be staying and supporting a husband. So our experience is that family members and wives and parents can't do right for doing wrong, actually, in these situations.
It's an impossible situation. I know you offer support. I'll be talking about what reforms are being asked for as well in the coming hour. Thank you so much, Jenny. Jenny Greensmith, Director of Safer Lives, which offers specialist support for people being investigated for online and other sexual offences.
The Voice of the UK. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The BBC News on 5 Live. I'm Bethan Holmes. David Cameron has returned to the Cabinet table for the first time in more than 7 years after his recall to government. A dramatic Cabinet overhaul yesterday saw the former Prime Minister step back into frontline politics as the new Foreign Secretary. Greeting his new team, Rishi Sunak set out his priorities.
A new approach to infrastructure spending, ushering in a generation of children that will grow up smoke-free, reforms to how we approach net zero to save families thousands of pounds, and radically reforming our education system with more teachers, higher standards, and more apprenticeships. That's the change that we're going to deliver. And looking around this table, I know that we have an energetic and enthusiastic team that is going to deliver for the country. So let's get to work.
The director of Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, says 179 people, including young children, are being buried in a mass grave. Mohammed Abu Salmaya says the patients died after vital hospital equipment failed due to power cuts caused by Israel's operation against Hamas. Israel says the hospital conceals a network of tunnels used by Hamas, a claim the hospital denies. The UK and the US have appealed to Israel's military to show restraint around the hospital. Melanie Ward is from the charity Medical Aid for Palestinians, and she's been speaking to Naga on 5 Live.
All we're calling for is for international law to be upheld, for fuel, medicine, food and water to be able to reach the civilians of Gaza, particularly those in the north, who have been denied any food or water in recent weeks. It's very clear that so many civilians are dying. We've seen UN schools targeted, the health system in Gaza systematically being dismantled. Almost two-thirds of hospitals in Gaza can no longer function. This is unacceptable, and it's time for world leaders to move from words of persuasion to action to make it stop.
Israel says it's in the process of coordinating the transfer of incubators to Gaza. In other news today, health officials have recommended the chickenpox vaccine should be given to children in the UK as part of their routine jabs. The Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation says two doses should be administered when they're 12 and 18 months. If approved, it would bring the UK in line with other countries, including the US and Germany. And the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, says it's heartening that stats show earnings are outstripping inflation at the fastest pace for 2 years. New data shows average regular earnings, excluding bonuses, increased by 7.7% in the 3 months to September. Now with the sports, here's Delith Lloyd.
Jude Bellingham and Levi Colwill are the latest pair to withdraw from England's squad for the upcoming Euro 2024 qualifiers against Malta and North Macedonia. They'll return to their respective clubs, Real Madrid and Chelsea, to continue their rehabilitation after sitting out their club games over the weekend with shoulder problems. The defending champion Ronnie O'Sullivan has pulled out of snooker's Champion of Champions event in Bolton, saying mentally he feels drained. O'Sullivan was due to play Zhang Ander tomorrow afternoon, but has now been replaced by China's Ding Junhui. And at the ATP Finals in Turin, unbeaten Novak Djokovic and home favourite Jannik Sinner face each other in a round-robin match tonight. In the group's other match, Stefanos Tsitsipas takes on Holger Rune this afternoon, a player he's never beaten, as they both look for their first wins of the tournament.
Whodunits, crime conundrums, murderous mayhem.
Why are you doing that voice?
I'm just getting in the mood for our new podcast.
Murder, They Wrote.
Hey, I'm Laura Whitmore.
And I'm Ian Sterling.
Now, anyone who knows us knows we are obsessed with true crime.
We're here with a new podcast exploring the dastardly deeds of history's most atrocious criminals.
There'll be mystery, madness, and moments of... oh, my God.
Murder, They Wrote with Laura Whitmore and Ian Sterling.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK. This is Five Live. Naga Manchetti. Listen live on digital, online, smart speaker or the BBC Sounds app.
Good afternoon to you. It's 5 minutes past midday. Your reaction to that rather remarkable interview with Lucy, Lucy's remarkable story coming in. What she did was tell me about what happened when her husband was arrested for downloading indecent images of children. She spoke to me about the impact it's had on her family and the lack of support, she says, is available for people like her. Steve texted in to say, I think we're hearing one of the bravest people ever to be on Five Live. Someone else, amazing lady to speak out. I've so longed to hear this. Shocking interview and a hard listen. I discovered my fiancé was accessing highly suspicious but not technically illegal images of girls and walked out of the house that moment with nothing but my phone, dripping wet hair in the middle of winter. I went to my best friend's house and she and her family put her arms around me. The relationship ended nearly 10 years ago, but the shock and horror never completely goes away. Someone else. My family member has a new identity and has left his whole life behind. We sold his house, moved his stuff. We pay for private therapy. I am still in therapy. Another. One of our family members arrested. Most traumatic year of our lives. The Lucy Faithful Foundation, Stop It Now, the most amazing charity that police gave to us. The reasons behind were horrendous, finding out about the nightmare of his life we didn't know about. And another, David in Surrey, says, I was a detective inspector leading what was referred to in the Met as the OCSAE team and also the Jigsaw teams, which manage sex offenders. Hearing your contributor sharing her experience shows the devastating effect offenders' behaviour has on their own families. She's very brave to do so. If you didn't catch it, I urge you to listen back to that interview on BBC Sounds. And we did approach the Home Office and Ministry of Justice for comment, which said no minister was available. However, a government spokesperson said, we sympathise with the challenges faced by unsuspecting families of sex offenders and have set up a specialist helpline to provide free and confidential support for those affected. This is in addition to charities who provide advice and help to these families, including PACT, NEPACS, the Lucy Faithful Foundation and Children Heard and Seen. I think this is an issue we're definitely going to talk about more on this programme in the future. 7 minutes past 12, still to come. I'm taking you to the Commons, actually, in just under half an hour. David Cameron's junior Foreign Office colleague, Andrew Mitchell, is going to make a statement. We'll talk about the chickenpox vaccine, which is going to be offered to toddlers on the NHS. That's what health advisers are recommending. And do keep your texts coming in. I've been asking if you've ever done a David Cameron. And by that, I mean returning to a job after being the boss, but at a lower rank. Steve texted in saying, hi, Naga, I was a head teacher. A year or so later, I was asked to go back to the college to help out with administration at the start of term. To give context, as well as processing all the new students, we had to ensure all the COVID safety measures were in place. Cutting a long story short, the actual head left, and they asked me to take over until the new person was appointed. Go figure. Keep them coming in. 85058 is the number to text in. So, the Prime Minister is meeting his new cabinet this morning, including one former Prime Minister, the now Lord David Cameron, who's the new Foreign Secretary. He was made a peer and appointed to the role by Rishi Sunak yesterday. Gone from the table is former Home Secretary Suella Braverman, sacked by phone yesterday morning, replaced by mid-morning by James Cleverly. It's led to some reported criticism from MPs on the right of the party. Let's find out more from David Campbell Bannerman, who's a former Conservative MEP. David, hello, good afternoon.
Hi, Naga. How
are
you doing?
Hi. What do you make of the reshuffle? Where do you stand in terms of the sacking of Suella Braverman?
Well, I think it was a terrible decision, actually. And I'm afraid I think it's firing the starting gun on a leadership contest, another one. And I think Sunak will be in real danger. I mean, it sends two messages. One is that this is the end of a Brexit government. You're bringing back the man who is the face of the Remain campaign. And though I've got a lot of regard for him personally, David Cameron, I think the message to the right of the party is, you know, we're no longer interested in Brexit. And I think the second thing is, as Lord Frost
hasn't
said,
Brexit
David Frost,
been done? Isn't that what the Conservatives
no,
have told
No, I don't
us?
Think it has. I mean, there's an awful lot in Northern Ireland problems, for example, to be sorted out. It's getting there, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And it's still capable of being reversed in a very negative way. I think the other thing, as Lord Frost has said, it's a sort of gesture towards social liberalism, back to sort of coalition days, pre-Brexit, which doesn't go down well. You know, Suella represented right of centre. She was what she'd said was actually very popular amongst the public, and that's often overlooked. I'm not saying it's all right, but actually, getting rid of her, a lot of our members and CDO, Conservative Democratic Organisation, are saying, well, you know, this is the last real Conservative being thrown out of the government, and what have we got left with?
She's the only right winger left, do you think?
Well, that's what members are saying. And, you know, she was taking a very brave stance. It was a very difficult, very courageous stance, not just on law and disorder, as I call it, but actually on, obviously, the border control and immigration. Of course, we've got the Rwanda case coming through tomorrow from the Supreme Court, a decision. And that's going to be very, very important because it's going to get us into issues like, do we leave the European Convention on Human Rights and not actually in anything to do with the EU, but a separate matter, and make our Supreme Court supreme again. So these matters, I think some of the people being brought into this government don't believe in taking such measures. And again, the right of the party is deeply unhappy. I think Suella is going to make a devastating speech. And, you know, the consequences of that, I think letters will pour in and we'll have a leadership contest. And I don't think Sunak is going to last very long.
Don't you think it's suicide, political suicide for the Conservative Party to hold a leadership contest in an election year?
Well, it's not election year yet. It's
it's going to happen within the next 12 months. That's pretty much widely agreed. Well, it has to happen by January 2024.
January 25, which is, you know, 1 year, 2 months to go.
It's enough time to recover from a leadership election, is it?
Yeah, I think it is, actually, because, we are crashing the polls, minus 20%. We've lost, we've had the worst by-elections ever in history, in mid-beds. And what's happening is Conservative voters are on strike, as I call it, 20,000 missing in mid-beds. And the only way you're going to get them back is to be more Conservative and return to real Conservative policies. Otherwise, they're off to Reform. Reform is now on 7%. I think once Farage has finished his jungle stint, that could be higher, could be over 10%. And that's a real threat as well. It's not just Labour. So I think we are in a desperate position, and if MPs want to survive, Conservative MPs, they're going to have to change a leader, return rapidly to real Conservative policies and swing more to the right. And if we do that, then a lot of our voters will return, and I think we can still win in a year's time.
Do you think the former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, after her comments about, say, the Met Police, saying they were playing favourites with some demonstrations, do you think she could have stayed on as Home Secretary, considering the relationship that she had clearly marked out with the Met Police?
Yes, I think, she doesn't have operational control of the precinct, but she does have oversight, as does the Mayor of London have oversight of the police and the way they police. And she's getting tremendous support. If you look at the polling, sometimes up to 80% back Suella. The point was, we needed
of whom,
a strong.
Sorry. 80%
well,
of
the public. I mean, various polls have gone up to 80%. But the point is, what they're saying, that the public wanted a robust response to these terrorist sympathisers hiding amongst a peaceful rally, mainly. But there were some very nasty elements, including one that was a knifeman that threatened someone with a poster. Michael Gove was actually threatened in a very nasty way. I mean, this was all brushed over because, and they then went and arrested a lot of sort of rather boisterous football supporters. And this was said then to be these far-right elements. Well, that's what she meant by two-tier policing. The police had given up actually, you know, taking on the anti-Semites. Those are actually real threats, a very great sympathy with Hamas, other terrorist organizations. And they go and arrest some football supporters. Well, that isn't good policing. And she's absolutely right to say that.
Did you see the scenes with those football, so-called football supporters, you're saying, the far-right protesters? Did you see the scenes?
I saw some of the clips.
Were they acceptable in your mind?
No, well, I don't like any violence. There was a bit of pushing and shoving.
There were people who were carrying weapons and Class A drugs who were arrested.
Well, I don't know. I've seen no evidence of that.
Well, the police
searched. They were searched.
And that's what the Metropolitan
Police
said.
I'm not saying they're all saints at all. But what I'm saying is, you know, compare that to Hamas supporters, people dressed with the headband of Hamas, flying Hamas flags, who are clearly sympathisers, who may well come back and try and kill us, in a terrorist incident at some point. I mean, you know, it's not comparable. That is two-tier policing. And that kind of weak policing is what Suella was opposing. And she was absolutely right to do so because it endangers all of us. And I was involved in the Northern Ireland peace process. I saw what happens when you get some pretty unpleasant groups, you know, threatening people and killing people, you know, and it gets very nasty. And law and order, I think, was compromised. And she was right to speak out on it.
I just want to clarify something. You said around 80% of the public backed Suella Braverman.
Yeah.
I'm just
some
seeing
of these polls. Yeah.
Well,
some
I'm looking at one poll which comes closest to the number you quoted. It was 72% of conservative voters, which believed that the planned pro-Palestine march in London shouldn't go ahead. And this was a poll reported by The Telegraph. In the run-up to an election, however long you feel that is in terms of how far away it is, do you think that, and I just want to clarify this with you, that Rishi Sunak will not win an election and needs to be replaced in order for the Conservatives to win an election? You believe credibly that the Conservatives could win an election under a new leader, the next election?
Yes, I do. And I'll give you the example of Boris Johnson. Now, he took over in June 2019 when we're only 9% of the polls. We've crashed about 20% at the moment. But he took over when it's only 9% under Theresa May. Then 6 months later, December 2019, he delivers the best election results since 1987. So that's an example where if you get the policies right and you appeal to, like, the Red Wall, as he did, you know, you can turn things around. And my main concern at the moment is Conservative voters are on strike and they will not come out or they'll vote Reform. And that's what will kill us. It's not, you know, trying to, you know, the swing votes is important, yes. But I think at the moment it's about getting our own supporters back in order to have a real chance of winning the next election.
Thank you so much for your time with me today on 5 Live. David Campbell Bannerman, former Conservative MEP. Thank you. It's 17 minutes past 12. You would have heard a little earlier, actually Nikki wrote this morning, health officials have recommended that all children in the UK should be given a chickenpox vaccine. It will now be up to the government to make a final decision on whether to implement the recommendations, which will come from the JCVI, which we all know now is the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. We also all know our brilliant medical editor, Fergus Walsh, who joins me in my studio. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Did you expect this?
I had an inkling that it was coming, but this vaccine's been around a long time, and we should talk about this, that some years ago, the JCVI, the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, decided against recommending this, and now they've changed their view on it. So the recommendation is that children aged 12 months and 18 months, so they'll get two doses, and then there'll be also a catch-up programme recommended for older children, but it will be the government that has to decide whether or not to implement this. Bit surprising that they haven't joined up with the government and both made the decision on the same day, because that would probably be more helpful to people to understand whether this is going to happen, which we don't know.
Fergus, I think you and I are of a similar age, and I remember having...
You're very kind.
I remember having chicken pox. I never had a chicken pox party, that's a whole other thing. Mm. But I remember having chicken pox, and it was just never... It always seemed fairly kind of like a rite of passage almost. It was fine. You got over it. There wasn't really real concern. Tell me what's changed.
So chickenpox is caused by the varicella zoster virus. It's highly infectious. And as you say, a lot of families have chickenpox parties with young kids because you want children to be exposed to the virus early on, and because the later you get it in life, the more dangerous it can be. And for the vast, vast majority of children, it is a mild, self-limiting illness. But it can cause serious disease where you have these open wounds. It can allow for bacterial infections, and in some cases you can have